The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's
the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. We have a good program, and I think you'll enjoy the topic, and let's get started. First of all, if you would like to call us today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so just be patient. And I'll answer and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email, which is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can post comments on our blog, which are on our website. So to do that, it's the upcoming show menu on the far right. This is the first show listed. You'll see Al Globus's name on it. And you open that show up, and comments and questions are down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your comment or question, I'll have it, and I can integrate it into our discussion. But the telephones are always our preferred way. And again, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Do visit the website, thespaceshow.com. So there is a very detailed website newsletter there, and it will be uploaded later today with the newsletter effective tomorrow morning for the coming week. And it will show you also all of the programs that are scheduled for the balance of the year and the programs we're starting to book for 2018. Note that everything we do is archived, and you can easily listen right off of our website or download the show. You can download them very fast if you have high-speed internet. There is a store in the upper left-hand menu under Support, and you'll see the Cafe Press store. Remember, it is a holiday time. Maybe you'll find a stocking stuffer suggestion or gift in that store, coffee mugs, Space Show t-shirts, things of nature like that. So do check it out, and we certainly appreciate that. And then over to the right of that is the Listen Live button. So this tells you how to listen to a live show, an archive show, all of our podcasting formatted shows. And for those of you using Alexa, the TuneIn player for Alexa is embedded there, and you can use that to listen to Space Show programs on Alexa. On the center right also, to me, is the most important part of our website, because this is where we ask you for your support. And we are in the annual campaign days for the Space Show. What we do between now and the end of year for fundraising dictates how we run the program and what we do for 2018. So this is a really important time for the Space Show, and we need your support to continue bringing you these programs and doing the things that the Space Show does. Remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3. If you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift, and the same is true if you're a California taxpayer. So check us out. Go to our nonprofit website, GiantLeapFoundation.org. If you have any questions about supporting us, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. But we do need your support. And as I said, your support tells us what kind of year we're going to have going forward for 2018. So we certainly look forward to your support, and we thank you, thank you, thank you very, very much for it. And in addition to the individuals that support us, we do have corporate sponsors. So you'll see their banner ads going across our website. And I read a short message from the sponsors on each segment of the program, which I will do in just a minute. But we are opened up for 2018 sponsors. So if you're interested in having your banner ad go across the website and your message read on every Space Show program, please email me for details, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. These sponsorships are very limited because we can't take up too much time reading sponsor messages because that eats into the guest talking time. So we're only willing to do that for a few minutes on each show. So that's why the sponsorships on the business corporate side are limited. But again, email me if you're interested in that program, and I will get right back to you. And, well, I guess I'll read our sponsor messages real quick since I'm talking about that. Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor, and they have the detailed 100-year forecast for our future in space. Their plan includes Earth-to-orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt plus space settlements. Their website, where you can check all this out, is thespaceplan.com. You can buy a full-size poster, which is really intriguing and very cool. I just got one in the mail from them. Thank you very much. And you can also get a space plan for your children. So visit thespaceplan.com for more information. The first segment is also sponsored by the Space Foundation, and they have their 34th symposium coming up just around the corner. And this is Connect and Engage with the Global Space Industry. At the 34th Symposium, it is April 16th through the 19th at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. All of the details are at spacesymposium.org. So I'm very happy to bring back to the program Al Globus, and Al is a NASA Ames contractor, and he's also extremely well known for his work with NSS and space settlements. And on several earlier space show programs, he has been discussing this LEO orbit with very low radiation that would be extremely ideal, as I guess the way to say it, for a beginning space settlement in space. And we have Al back with us for some updated information and more about this subject. Al, welcome back to the show. Happy holidays to you, and I hope all is going well.
Yeah, we're doing okay. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. So for new listeners and people who may not grasp what you're talking about, give us a brief introduction and then we'll get going.
Okay. Now, the fundamental reason that we don't have space settlements today, I mean, people have been talking about space settlements for over a century, is they're extremely difficult to build. Don't let anybody tell you anything else. And so if we want to build some space settlements, we need to find the easiest possible path, in my view, to get to that first space settlement. And there's several things it turns out we can do. We can make those settlements very, very close to Earth. We can make them small as we dare to make them. We can make them as with as little mass as conceivably possible. And we can make them without a whole lot of system complexity. And the sort of the key to all that is the concept of an equatorial low Earth orbit. And that just refers to a satellite in low orbit, you know, say 500-600 kilometers up, that stays very close to the equator. And the reason that it's important to stay close to the equator is there is a region of low radiation at about 500-600-700 kilometers up directly over the equator, or very close to the equator, within maybe 5 degrees or so. And if you look at the designs for space settlements that came out of Jerry O'Neill's work back in the 70s, they're huge and they're massive. They weigh millions of tons. And the reason they weigh millions of tons is you need an awful lot of radiation shielding, because there's a lot of radiation in space. But in this little region, equatorial low Earth orbit, it's also called ELEO, within ELEO, radiation levels are quite low. As a matter of fact, they are so low that it is plausible, not proven, but plausible, and fairly plausible, that you will need no dedicated radiation shielding in order to live there at reasonable radiation levels. And specifically, if you look at a bad year for radiation, we've done calculations that show that the settlers shouldn't receive more than about 17 or 18 millisieverts in a year. And 20 millisieverts is the occupational limit for radiation workers on Earth. So you're not gonna go into space without getting more radiation than you get on Earth, unless you live in certain places which do have very high radiation. But it's at a level which appears low enough that you don't need dedicated shielding. Now, you'll get some shielding from the hull, and you'll get some shielding, quite a bit of shielding from the life support system if you've got a lot of water. So it's not like you're completely unshielded. But the basic thing is you don't need it. That makes a massive difference in the mass of a space settlement. Typical space settlement designs, the radiation shielding is 98-99% of the mass. And if you get rid of that, that makes everything massively easier. And at the same time, instead of putting your settlement at lunar distances or asteroidal distances or around Mars or on Mars or the moon, which is, you know, very far away, we're talking about 500 kilometers straight up. And that has really important implications. First of all, just everything's easier because it's easier to do things close than it is to do things far. The second is, once you're done and you're living there, which isn't going to happen for a few decades at least, you can plug into the Earth's communication system because you're right there. You're only 500 kilometers away. You know, that's not a long way. So you can plug directly into the Earth's communication system and you can work. Okay? You can get a job to pay off the massive mortgage that you took out to buy your condo on a space settlement. So that's one thing. That gets your settlements very small in terms of mass. And it also makes your settlements very close, which, you know, makes everything much, much easier. The second thing is that if you look at the settlement designs from the 70s, they're all very large. And one of the reasons that they're very large is that you want to rotate these structures to get artificial gravity so your kids will grow up with muscles and bones comparable to kids on Earth, right? If you grow up in low gravity, there's lots of things that are going to happen to you, most of which you don't know what they are. But one of the things that's very safe to bet is that you will grow up weak because you don't have as much stress on your bones and muscles, and bone and muscle develop in response to stress. Okay. So there's always thought that if you rotated at more than one or maybe two RPMs, rotations per minute, that you'd get sick, and that was a killer trade. You can't do that because you're going to get up there and you get motion sick. It's going to be awful. But here's the thing that somehow people did not notice. Yes, if you go into a rotating environment at, say, 4 RPM, rotations per minute, then, yes, you will get sick probably, and you will recover within a few hours or a couple of days, okay, if you're particularly susceptible. It's like going to Nepal. If we all, you know, hopped in a plane and ran off to Nepal right now, we get down there, we all get sick as dogs from altitude sickness. But that doesn't mean people can't live in Nepal. I mean, people do live in Nepal. And the facts of the matter is, even as a visitor, if you go to Nepal in 3 or 4 days, you're going to be okay, you know, unless there's some, you know, medical problem or something like that. Now, here's the trick. If you go from 1 RPM to 4 RPM, you make the radius around your rotation go down by a factor of 4.
Okay.
So you get a big reduction in size. So that means you can build your settlements with not much mass because they don't need radiation shielding. You can build them very close because this area of low radiation is very close to Earth. And you can rotate faster, and instead of having to build something the size of a large town with 10,000 people, you can build something the size of a large cruise ship with 500 people, which is a lot easier to do. Now, of course, the second settlement you might want to make a little bit bigger because this is going to be pretty small, but it will work. So that's most of the idea. There's a second piece to it, which is how do you develop the ability to build a structure that's 100 meters across, a pressure vessel in space 100 meters across. You know, we know we can build something about 100 meters across because the ISS is. You know, the International Space Station is about 100 meters long, but each individual module that's pressurized is only a few meters wide. You know, it's not very big, that's a very cramped thing to live in. You know, it's one thing to get into a capsule, a very small capsule, and spend a year in space or to go to the moon or whatever. It's another thing to go and live there permanently and try to raise your kids. Okay, you don't want to do that in a tin can. You want something big. So how do you build that? We don't really know. I mean, there's ideas, but we don't really know. What about the life support system? How do you grow enough food to feed everybody continuously and reuse the human waste outputs to go back into fertilizer? Well, we sort of know how to do that. We can kind of do it, but we don't really know how to do it. All these things need to get worked out, and they can all get worked out by tourist hotels, or almost all worked out by tourist hotels. If some people are willing to spend a lot of money to go into space and be a tourist. People have spent $10, $20, $30 million to do that. Right? There used to be the Russians used to fly tourists up to the International Space Station, and obviously the market's not very big at that kind of pay. But if you can get the price of launch down, which, for instance, Elon Musk is doing a very fine job of, I might say, that the size of that market increases, and that could feed a need for space hotels. And those space hotels operating at a profit could work out these problems. So that's sort of the guts of the whole idea behind ELIO space settlements. Stay directly over the equator or very close to it, equatorial low Earth orbit. You won't get a whole lot of radiation. You don't need radiation shielding, or not very much at the very most. Two, so that gets you close, that gets you small in mass. Then two, rotate faster. Rotate at 4 RPM, and you will discover that you adapt, and you'll be okay. And that means you can make a settlement that's 100 meters diameter instead of having to make something 1,700 and some odd meters diameter, which is what you have to do at 1 RPM. And then the third piece of it is use the tourism industry as a means to develop the kind of facility that you want, so that by the time it comes time to build yourself a space settlement, you just build a hotel and rotate it faster.
So the people that are on the station for a longer period of time, they're there only to service a tourist industry? That's the only economy for this space station?
Oh, not at all. Okay?
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it's a space settlement. Space station is a place where you go to work. Space settlement is a place where you go to live. Okay? So, first of all, one of the things you can do is service the tourists. Okay, the tourists will come, that's fine. But another thing you can do is you can do anything in the information economy. Okay, remember we're talking at least a few decades from today. And if you look at the communication system that we have, it's awesome. It's amazing. And in another 20 years, it's going to be just mind-bogglingly fantastic. Okay? So what that means is that you'll be able to work remotely almost as if you were on site. So one of the ways that you can do all of this is you build your space settlement, and you think of it as a real estate development, and you build a bunch of condos on it for people to live in, and then you sell the condos to people. And the way that people can afford the condos, because they're going to be millions of dollars each, at least at first, is they take out a mortgage, just like you do when you buy a house now. You know, very few people plunk down cash for a house. Almost everybody gets a loan from the bank, we call it a mortgage, and they pay it off over 15 or 20 or 30 years, or whatever like that. So the problem is that you're faced with, you bought your condo, and you've got a couple of million dollars mortgage. How do you service that mortgage? How do you pay those payments? Well, one way you do is just get a job on Earth in the information economy where you can plug into this incredible communication system, which is underdeveloped right now and which will get developed no matter what we do in the space settlement business. And, just have a job and work like you would anywhere else. And you can't do every job, but you can do a lot of jobs. And I'll give you an example of one job, mining. So you think you have to be on site to mine? No. There are mines today where the people who are actually operating the mine are 150 miles away in a special facility, and they're teleoperating the mining gear. There's still people at the mine site itself to do repairs and fix things and deal with problems that come up. But, here you can think, you think of a miner as somebody who goes with a pickaxe into a hole in the ground, and these miners are just, you know, they're sitting in an office somewhere in a cubicle with a special purpose interface and a big screen in front of them. And that's just one example. Programmers, for instance, software programmers now today, you know, frequently work all over the place. There's people that, you know, that live in Italy and work for a firm in San Jose. You know, I know people like that. And that trend will continue. So that's one thing you can do, just get a regular job. The second thing you could do is you could build, you could assemble, check out, and send on its way very large satellites. Right now, the size of a satellite is governed, the maximum size of a satellite is governed by the size of the launch fairing. That's the piece of hardware that goes around the satellite to protect it from aerodynamic forces during launch. Okay. But that limits the size. But you could, in principle, instead of launching a whole satellite, you could launch up parts. And you could launch them in several launches, and you could have a lot of parts, and you could send them up. And then people in ELEO could assemble those parts into a satellite, check it out, make sure everything works, and then send it on its way to go where it wants to go. Now, if you wanted to build very, very large communication satellites, because don't forget, communication satellites make $200+ billion a year. This is a, you know, business that makes money and has for a long time. If you can build a really large communication satellite, the devices on the ground can be smaller. Okay? That's just sort of fundamental physics. The larger the satellite, the larger the antennas, the more power you have, the smaller the devices on the ground. And, of course, small devices on the ground has got a nice booming market to it. Okay. Now, if you wanted to build very large communication satellites, you wouldn't build a settlement in low Earth orbit first. But, I mean, it's kind of a distraction. You could probably find some way to teleoperate it. But if you wanted to build a very large communication satellite and there were 500 people in low Earth orbit, in ELEO, ready and willing to work with skills and a deep knowledge of the space environment, you would be a fool not to hire them. Okay? You have a competitive advantage. Now, if these communication satellites get larger and larger, after a while, once they get big enough, they are so large you could actually beam power to Earth. Okay? That's much, much, much larger than current communication satellites. But there's a fairly smooth path. And that we're talking about space solar power, of course. Again, if you're trying to build a space power satellite industry, you started today, you wouldn't build a space settlement to do it. But if there was a space settlement already in place with people who need to make money to pay their mortgage, you would be a fool not to hire them because they're in exactly the right place. They really understand the environment. They can deal with all the problems that come up. And you can make your systems much more simply and more straightforward. So that's another way to make money. You can do R&D, right?
Right.
And that's how Zubrin wants to pay for his Mars colonization, is all the great discoveries from the people living on Mars. There will be lots of pressure in ELEO settlements to do, you know, wild and crazy and wonderful things, just as there will be on Mars. So you can do R&D. And the other source of funding to do this, quite frankly, is angels. People who think that space settlement is very, very important and have a lot of money. And, you know, some of those people exist, like Elon Musk. What he really wants to do is, you know, not necessarily build rocket ships, though he seems to like that and do very well at it. But what he really wants to do is colonize Mars. Right? And then you have Jeff Bezos, who is pledged to put $1 billion a year into his rocket company. And he's not doing that because he's in love with rocket companies, although I'm sure he likes them, but rather because he sees a world in which, you know, thousands and later millions of people are living and having a great time living in space. So there's a number of potential financing approaches. There's a couple of ways that you can make money. There may be some that I haven't thought of. And that would be great.
You have a caller on hold. Are you ready to take your first call?
Absolutely.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Oh, this is Marshall, and I'm in my usual place in Renfro.
Okay, go ahead, Marshall.
I want to start off by saying, oh, I love it when somebody talks economics. So you're A-grade right there. Second, the equatorial Leo, I didn't have a clue about that. Thank you for letting us know. And third, one of the key things about getting spacefaring nations, being a spacefaring species, is getting the environment clean enough for women to have children. And you're at least paving a path down that road. Have you looked at the radiation requirements that you must keep under to do that?
Yes, actually, if there's a paper about this on published at the NSS Space Settlement Journal site, and we actually, in the way we handled the radiation was we did this two projects. One project was to say, okay, what is the acceptable levels? And that was a literature search, which took years, because it turns out there's a ton of literature on radiation.
And yes, and a whole bunch of it is just people saying, I think.
Well, there's also a very deep literature of real experts who examine the data and do experiments and stuff like that. Because, for instance, there's concern about medical radiation and radiation from nuclear power plants and so forth. There's a lot of work on this. Not all of it is applicable as you'd like, because in equatorial low Earth orbit, in ELEO, the only radiation, space radiation, you're really exposed to is very high-energy cosmic nuclei, like iron nuclei stripped of all their electrons moving at relativistic speeds. That's the only stuff that gets through. And it's very difficult to gather data on low levels of that kind of radiation, because there really isn't a lot. I mean, there's like 16, 17 millisieverts in a really bad year in equatorial Leo. So there's not a whole lot of radiation, and it's very difficult to do an experiment where you see any effect at all, right? But the point I was trying to get to is that we came up with a limit of 20 millisieverts per year for the general population, and we have a separate limit of 5 milligrays per year for pregnant women. And the reason we use grays instead of sieverts is that the way you calculate sieverts is you take grays, which tells you how much radiation there is, and then you multiply it by factors depending on what kind of radiation it is, number one, and number two, what kind of tissue or material is being irradiated. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out there is no good way, and there's standard conversions from grays to sieverts, and people argue about whether they're right or wrong, and they have papers, and it's a legitimate issue. But it turns out, at least in the references that I read, that there is no good way to calculate sieverts from grays for the fetus, because the fetus, the susceptibility of the fetus to radiation damage is a function of time, among other things. And we know this from the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that in certain windows, I can't remember the window, like from 2 to 6 weeks, if you get radiation, it'll do this, but from 6 weeks to 16 weeks, you get the same radiation, it doesn't do anything. Right.
Mm-hmm.
None of that's correct, but that's the flavor of the sort of thing that's going on. So in any case, if you look at very few of the effects on the fetus, radiation effects on the fetus kick in below 100 milligrays. There are some. And the lowest that I can find in the literature of anything, of any sort of negative effect on the fetus at all, was 10 milligrays. And so we cut that in half and called it 5 milligrays. Now, because 5 milligrays per pregnancy, I think I said per year before, that 5 milligrays per pregnancy. Now, pregnancy is 9 months, not 12 months. So on a yearly basis, you can accept, according to the best we can do, is 6.6 milligrays per year. And if you go to the paper on radiation at the NSS Space Settlement Journal, it has tables with columns for sieverts and gray, millisieverts and milligrays, so that you can see the effect of both both limits. Right? And it turns out, and I don't know if this is just dumb luck or what, that the for a given amount of shielding, very often the crossover point where you go from unacceptable radiation to acceptable radiation is either the same or very close to the same for the pregnant women and the regular population.
Very interesting. Next fun little topic is, and I know this is a very nice topic because David loves it, what about pets? You've got to have your dog.
Well, okay. I go back to the thing. The second thing we did, one was established limits. The second thing we did is we used Ulteris, which is NASA's front end to their radiation codes, to calculate the radiation in the orbits that we carried about. Yeah, we did a lot of that. So pets. Well, it's a matter, my guess is it's a matter of money. Because, you know, to fly the most optimistic number you can find anywhere by somebody who plausibly knows what they're doing is about $100,000 a flight to low Earth orbit. $100,000 to $200,000 a flight to low Earth orbit. And that's for either the ITS or the BFR, depending on which one you like the most that came out of SpaceX, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's for the ITS. It's actually on the Elon's presentation materials that it was $200,000 to take a person from the surface of the Earth to the surface of Mars. And there's two legs to that. One is from the surface of the Earth to LEO, and the other one is from LEO to Mars. And so we just sort of said, well, we only care about the first leg, and we're just going to assume that that's half the cost. It actually would be quite a bit less than half the cost, but we're just being conservative. And so you come up with $100,000 per flight for a person. Okay, so if two dogs displace one person on the flight, then it's going to be, you know, $50,000 per mutt. To take them up into space. But that's the cheap part. That's the cheap part. The expensive part with the BFR or with the ITS is the stuff. And that runs, let's say it runs about $70 per kilogram for the ITS, and I think about $130 per kilogram if you assume $20 million of flight for the BFR.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, a person in the paper, there's a paper on Easy Way to Space Settlements on that same NSS Space Settlement Journal. In that paper, we estimated 17 tons per person as your share of everything except your condo. So the idea is you buy your condo, and then you buy ownership in the facility, in the communication system, the power system, the agriculture system, and so forth and so on. That runs out at about 17, in that paper, runs into 17 tons per resident. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, you're going to have to figure your dog into there somehow, because your dog, you know, breathes air and eats food and needs to be cleaned up after, and that stuff needs to be dealt with. You can't just throw it in a trash can and think that it's going to go away. So I don't know how you would go about calculating the cost, and that's most of the cost. That's $1.15 million at Culper One. Now, there's a wrinkle in that is since the paper has been published, better estimates of the agricultural system have come out, and they're quite a bit higher.
Oh.
On the other hand, this is another paper on the NSS the Space Settlement Journal, is a one about multi-stage space agriculture. It's a really good paper. It is not optimized for mass, so there may be savings that can be accrued, but we just haven't, that optimization step hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Did that answer your question?
Well, I thought you were going to come in with the conclusion of you only get chihuahuas.
Oh. Well, that's my approach.
Next fun topic was you talking about building large satellites, and I have been on a kick lately reading about James Webb and my thoughts on what could be done beyond James Webb for, you know, the next generation space telescope. And if you can come in there and literally assemble a space telescope in low Earth orbit, A, it can be a whopper, and B, you can also repair it. And we found out from Hubble that repairing them is by far the best way of doing things. And I just come in there and go,
designed for it either.
And
the only thing about telescopes, the telescopes are great, but the market is quite small. I mean, you get one space telescope built every 5 or 10 years if you're lucky. It's not enough to sustain a, I mean, yes, it's some extra revenue and stuff, but it's not enough to sustain, you know, an industry full of space settlements.
Good point, good point. Anyway, let's see. That's all the fun. I've already talked more than I should. I'll let somebody else call in and ask you some more fun questions.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye-bye.
Listeners, Marshall has cleared the line, and if you would like to use it, it is 1-866-687-7223. I have an email from Washington. I think it's Washington State, but I'm not 100% sure, from Karen. And she says, in your discussion about pregnancy and radiation, you automatically assume that fetuses can be born and that they would be normal. There's absolutely no evidence of that. Gravity plays a role in the fetal position during pregnancy. There's all sorts of issues that are unknown, and maybe radiation would be doable. That's not even really clear. But what information do you have that it's even feasible to conceive in space, let alone bring a healthy baby to term and then have the baby grow up, even if you're spinning the spaceship at an acceptable rate? Where is there evidence for that, or do you want your kids to be the prime example and experimentation?
Well, the first thing is that the idea behind settlements is you don't live in a weightless environment. You rotate the facility so that if you're at the rim, you experience something that is very close to 1G. So that's the first thing. So the caller's point is extremely well taken. You know, this is an absolutely critical issue. You cannot have space settlement without birth, and it hasn't been proven in humans at all. Now, there's no particular reason to believe it would necessarily work on Mars or the Moon either.
No, of course not.
Those are less than.
I think the real question is how you prove it.
Animal data on this sort of thing. Fruit flies have been bred in space through multiple generations, no problem. Mice have been, I do not believe that anybody's gone through a complete cycle of impregnation, growth, and gestation, and then birth. But there have been mice, I believe, not my area of expertise, there have been mice that have been impregnated on the ground, flown in space, and carried their little mice children to term. And here, in weightlessness, okay, so it's a more extreme environment. And then, interestingly, apparently the big problem that a lot of the mice died quite young, and the problem was that in a weightless environment, they weren't able to latch onto a teat in order to get fed. Just mechanically, they couldn't figure out how to do it. But if you're in a rotating environment, that shouldn't be a problem. So there is some evidence that animals can grow in space and go through gestation, come to term, and bear a healthy offspring. And that's in a weightless environment. In a rotating environment where you have weight, where it feels very close to, there's every expectation that you would get the same sort of mechanical result.
How do you think the experimentation for human fetal development, pregnancy, child rearing, all of that, in the space environment can take place? How do you even make those experiments happen? Would you actually try to do it in space and get the right consents and approvals to try a pregnancy in space for real and bring a kid up? What would you do?
You do what you do with like drugs. You start with animals. And you get everything worked out with animals until you're very confident all the way through ideally primates, although there might be some issues with consent with primates.
Slightly.
but in any case, you can certainly do that with rodents and other small mammals. So you can do all the preliminary work. And my guess is, this is a guess, not a research topic, that the first human pregnancies in space will not be as part of a controlled experiment, but rather will be somebody working in a space hotel becoming pregnant and not even realize for a few months, 1 month maybe, and then by the time people realize that this person is pregnant, they'll probably try to ship them to Earth. But they may not necessarily succeed. So my guess is that your hotel staff will be the first pregnancies in space, and rather than a controlled experiment. But I think you can do the experiments with animals, and I don't know if you can go all the way to monkeys, but you can certainly even bump up from rodents a little bit and understand the basic things and see if you see there's a killer problem.
Have you heard of anybody trying to do this kind of experimentation, or is it just too early still?
Well, I mean, a very stone minimum you need to even get started is a rodent-capable centrifuge, right? Which we don't have.
Well, like, don't we have rodent centrifuges on the station right now?
We have centrifuge fruit flies and tissue, but not rodents.
Okay.
Well, there might be a small one in there somewhere, but it's not the situation that you would like. The rodent research on station is not my area of expertise. Actually, my sister is a stone expert in that. She works at NASA Ames Research Center. She's a civil servant who has a bone lab. Where they study radiation and lightness effects on bones. But the thing is, most of the focus of these studies nowadays is not for a rotating environment. It's for a weightless environment, where the question is much, much more acute. And there's every reason to believe the rotating environment is very close to the gravity environment we have on Earth, whereas, of course, weightlessness is completely different. And we know it's completely different.
What does it take for your idea of an ELEO station to actually get going? Is it a massive equity crowdfunding program? How do you start it? How do you stop talking about it and start actually doing it?
Right.
You're the first mayor of the city or whatever.
Right.
How do you do it?
Well, there are two paths. I will go with the one that I do not think is going to happen first. Somebody gives you an enormous pile of money, and you just go build the sucker. Okay? That's one way to do it. I don't really think that's a particularly good way to do it. The way that I'm favor is that you put in some subsidies, and you train the market. Maybe you have tax exemptions or whatever, so that a tourism industry gets started. And if somebody's bound to notice that the difference between a space station, actually, let me step back one step. Where we start is with the ISS, the International Space Station. That's what we've got. That's what we can start with. And NASA has been required by Congress, although they have not done it, they are required to produce a report for Congress that says, here's how we transition in a gapless manner, no gap in services, from what we have now, the International Space Station, to private commercial stations that NASA can lease, can become an anchor tenant, and that they can attract other users. The same model that was used to develop the Falcon 9 by the COTS program, a decade ago or so. The same basic idea. The government helps with the money, and lets them pretty much do what they want, but they have to have their own skin in the game. And the idea is at the end of that will come out these commercial stations. Now, if you have a commercial station and you also have a budding tourist market, perhaps people just flying up, going around three or four times and coming back like John Glenn, somebody's going to notice the difference between a space station module and a space hotel module is you take out all of that expensive science gear. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So it is cheaper to build a tourist module than it is to build a science module. A lot cheaper, I might add. Okay? So if you've got this, you know, a couple of commercial stations floating around, you know, in orbit, wherever they happen to be, adding a module that is dedicated for tourism is relatively easy thing to do compared to doing one that's supposed to do science. And then you got started. If it makes money, if it does well, there will be more, and they will be bigger, and they will be better. And this could go on for a couple of decades until you're building space hotels that are 100 meters in diameter. They rotate at a slow rate so you do not have to learn how to use a zero-G toilet, which is simultaneously difficult, and when you screw up, which you will, disgusting. Okay? So you don't have to do that. You can have some gravity when you go to the bathroom. You can shower and things like that. Just a little bit of artificial gravity, maybe the lunar lift. You can still play around in zero-G at the center of the axis rotation. In any case, so you start building hotels the size of a cruise ship, today's large cruise ship, it's not really very much different than a space settlement. Okay? So the next thing you do is you build a space settlement. And instead of, you know, renting out hotel rooms for a week here and there, you sell condos to the settlers. There are actually cruise ships that have that model today. You know, most cruise ships, you know, you rent your cabin for a week and you go and or 2 weeks or whatever, and you go and you do your trip. But there are a few cruise ships, at least one, I believe there's a couple, that you buy your stateroom, and you can come live in it anytime you please, and the ship just goes around the world looking for good weather on a regular basis. So that's that same kind of model of development. That's my preferred approach. I think it is much more likely to work. Dennis Wingo is fond of saying, trust not in the whims of princes, but rather in the avarice of merchants.
You got another caller. So,
okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Go for it, Kim.
Hi, Al.
Hi.
Yeah, I remember seeing you talk in Puerto Rico at the ISTC in 2016.
Uh-huh.
And recall Stephen Covey talking about the materials that the station would be made out of, and talking about them, you know, being advanced fibers. I think it's kept. I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
And I wondered if you've been able to extract the information of how that material would behave long term in orbit, and what kind of matrix needs to be in to protect it. I recall saying that it would be strong enough to make very thin walls,
uh-huh.
and probably they would be made thicker simply because people would find that kind of uncomfortable or would feel weird.
Yeah.
But is there material studies for that to know what kind of protection you need from material and how it would react over the years?
Well, I mean, we know quite a bit about aluminum modules because the ISS and previous space stations were built out of various kinds of aerospace aluminum. So we have a lot of data on how that stands up in the low Earth orbit environment, which is a pretty harsh environment, by the way. Not only do you have most satellites and LEO have been hit by at least something small, or at least a lot of them have, but we have a lot of data on how they work. And right now, Bigelow has their inflatable module up on the station. It was there for a couple of years for testing, and now I believe they're using it for storage, but don't quote me on that. And it's made out of a flexible material, so you launch it, unpressurized, relatively small, and then you pressurize it from tanks that have the appropriate atmosphere in them, and then it gets much larger. So it gets around this fairing problem to a certain extent. And as far as I can tell, they're doing, it's doing quite well. I mean, if they had any concern that it was going to start leaking at a significant rate, they would have not kept it on board. So that's I don't know if you remember the LDEF, the Long Duration Exposure Facility. It was a satellite put up by the shuttle in the very early days of the shuttle, and the idea was to leave it in orbit for a year and then bring it down, and it had every inch of its surface was covered with materials, and you could examine those materials and see how they held up to the LEO environment. And so there's a lot of data from that mission. It ended up staying up quite a bit longer than 1 year. I can't remember the exact reason. It might have been involved in the Challenger accident that might have got caught by that, or maybe they just kept delaying it because they had other things to do or something like that. The other thing that's going on is Maiden Space has got their facility to build 3D printed objects inside the International Space Station, and I believe that they have a project. But in SM, they have a project. Are they certainly thinking about how to use 3D printers on the outside, which has got some nice advantages. It's a very good vacuum. When you're making things inside the ISS, you don't want little bits of metal and plastic floating around, right? You have to do everything in a glove box, and you have to have procedures to avoid little droplets of stuff that doesn't quite make it into the part. That's how it all has to go somewhere, and it's got to be collected and so forth. You don't have to worry about that so much outside. You just don't want to be creating a whole lot of orbital debris. But at ISS altitudes, which is about 400 kilometers, there's a fair amount of atmosphere by space standards. So small objects that get left, get lost by the 3D printer will probably deorbit pretty quickly. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does pretty well, although I thought that because of the artificial gravity that it would be necessary to use something like Kevlar, that the forces would be too high for aluminum, but...
Aluminum can handle it. I'm pretty sure the studies back in the 70s used aluminum as their material of choice. If you go to some sort of carbon-based system, that can be a lot stronger for per unit mass. So your structure in our calculations on the Easy Space Settlement paper, we switched from aluminum to carbon based stuff because it reduced the mass requirement quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
This is the sort of thing that I expect to get worked out building hotels, right? There are a million issues like this. I mean, tons and tons and tons of issues, which for an engineer is great. Engineers like nothing so much as a good problem to solve, right? And there are, at this sort of level that you're talking, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of engineering problems that need to be solved kind of at that level. And it's all really, interesting and fun and a great thing to work on.
Sure. I was interested because you commented that the second settlement would be built separately and that how it's built is one of the large questions. And it sort of surprised me that there wouldn't be a clear advantage to doing a modular construction where even if you're making quite a large addition, that one way or another you'd find a way to add it on to the original station. Is that not true?
There are ideas about that, but it's actually, you could, there have been like, there'll be a torus of Bigelow modules or something like that. Now, what you can do, it's really hard to stick something, you've got this thing at a certain distance, and it's rotating at a certain rate. It's pretty hard to, like, break it apart and stick a module in and make it a little bigger and then slow down the radiation. It's not that you can't do it, but it's pretty tricky, and if you screw, there's a lot of force involved. You got 1G, so when you detach these things, sometimes you've got to keep them under control, put them back together. So what that means is you're probably going to grow on the around the axis of rotation. So you're not going to change the diameter, but you're going to make it higher. Now, there are limits to how far you can go, because if you go too high, if the height of your cylinder starts to get too great, you will the moment of inertia wants to be end over end instead of around the axis of rotation. And, of course, you can control that with active controls, but it's always better if you can depend on physics to avoid a big problem. So what will happen is if you get a long, skinny thing in orbit and you rotate it around the long axis, after a while, you'll get various perturbations, and if you don't do anything after a while, it'll start spinning end over end. Okay, it'll spin 90 degrees to how it started out. And that's because the moment of inertia is greater when you're going end to end than you are around. So you have to watch out. So there's a limit to how far you can go. It has always seemed to me easier to simply build another one of what you've already done. You know how to do it. You did it, right? And you might want to put some improvements and so forth. And so maybe you want to make it a little bigger. So maybe in the first one, maybe it's 112 meters. That gives you exactly 4 RPM. Well, maybe the second one you do for 150 meters radius, and you can slow the rotation down a little bit and have a little bigger place to live in. But almost all the lessons that you learned in the last in building this thing in the first place, those all apply. And all the techniques that you came up with, all those apply, as opposed to doing something quite different. But that's just a bias of mine. It's nothing. It's not written in the cosmos that you can't have some sort of expanding system. But all the expanding systems I've seen look really hard to pull off.
So a gravity gradient doesn't help to stabilize it. Doesn't help stabilize it unless it's fairly long.
This isn't a matter of gravity. This will happen independent of gravity. This is a matter of the moment of inertia. So if you've got a long skinny thing and you're rotating around the long axis, you've got a very small moment of inertia because all the mass is very close to where you're rotating. If you're rotating end over end that same object, most of the mass is a long ways from the center of rotation. That's why you have the higher higher moment of inertia. Now, if space were perfect and there were no perturbations, this wouldn't happen. If you had a perfect free fall environment and there were no perturbations, there was no moon, there was no Jupiter, there was no uneven mass distribution in the Earth, none of that was the case. There was no atmosphere. This wouldn't matter. But there are perturbations, and the moon is going to come by every 28 days, right? And on a 28 day cycle, you're going to be subjected to the moon. The Earth does have. The Earth's gravitational field is not uniform, and it is not just r squared with distance. It's lumpy, okay. And in low Earth orbit, you have quite a bit of atmosphere. It's going to introduce more perturbation. So every time you perturb this system, it's going to want to head in the direction of the highest moment of inertia, and that's why. If you fly a long skinny thing and think you're going to rotate around the long axis, you're wrong. You're not going to, unless you have some sort of active system, which can push the system back into the state you want it.
Well, I was thinking of the case of space tethers, which are so long, something that isn't rotating, which is usually what people study, but they're so long that you can orient them vertically. And it'll hang vertically because it's being pulled towards the Earth.
Yes, yes.
But you can't
live on a tether. Settlements is about living there. Tethers got all kinds of wonderful properties. I presume you know Jill Carroll. He's one of my favorite space people.
Al, I think we lost her.
Go
ahead, and if she calls back, I don't know, her line was maybe breaking up. Maybe that was the problem. I don't know.
Okay. Well, no, I don't, I'm fine.
No, she's gone. We'll see if she can call back. While we're waiting, Kim, if you are able to call back. And by the way, listeners, I might point out we have an on-time ending today, so we do need to be succinct. Listen to me. Succinct. Doug has two questions for you. The first one is real short. Do you think that the first pregnancy would be a tourist? They wouldn't carry it to term in space, but they might have become pregnant in space. Okay, so I guess that's a possibility. Let's see. Then he goes on to say, can you give an estimate of the following dates? One, when the first space hotel will accept their first tourist, and number two, when the first permanent couple settles in ELEO.
Okay, I'm going to switch phones. I think my other phone is running out of battery.
Oh, charming.
So I'm going to turn the second handset on and turn the first handset off, and hopefully we won't lose each other.
Okay.
I'll answer the question after this.
Okay.
Here we go.
This is my day for phone problems, everybody.
you still got me?
Yeah, I still got you, Al.
Okay, good.
Okay, great. So Doug's emails.
Well, I think the chance of the hotel staff becoming pregnant in space is much larger than for the tourists because the staff are there for longer periods of time. Although maybe it doesn't really matter. I take that back. Because although a given tourist is staying there for a short period of time, put together, if you assume that the staff is just as many staff as tourists, which is about what it is on these cruise ships, the total of space hours per woman is the same, regardless of whether you have one person staying up there for a 2-year contract, or you have somebody coming up for, have 104 people coming up for a week at a time. So, the probability that the first pregnancy is staff versus tourists depends on how many tourists you have relative to the staff. And if you have a typical cruise ship allocation, it's about a 50-50 shot.
Okay.
So as to dates, when the first hotel opened up in the 2000s when Dennis Tito went to the International Space Station. Now, it wasn't a great hotel, but that's what its function was. That's already happened. And what was the second half of the question?
Okay, let me go back to... hold on. The first space hotel will accept the first tourist, and when the first permanent couple will settle in ELEO.
Oh, well, as the first people to settle in on ELEO, there's two scenarios. One is... Let's just say we follow my plan. You build the hotels get bigger and bigger. You finally build the first settlement, and you sell the first condo to a couple, and they go up. Okay. I don't know how long that will take, but I think I know the right unit of measurement, and that is decades. Okay.
Okay.
Now I don't think we're definitely not talking years. It's not going to happen in some, in 5 or 10 years or something like that. And I don't think it's going to take centuries. Okay, I don't think it's going to take hundreds of years. It certainly doesn't have to. So I think the right unit of measurement is decades, and I think the answer is in some smallish number of decades, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, something like that. And that's about as accurate as I believe anybody could do, honestly.
Okay.
Now the second scenario, and that is, that the staff of a hotel includes a husband and wife.
Okay.
Right? Now that could happen fairly quickly, 5 or 10 years, 15 years. Depends on how long it takes to start getting luxury hotels going. I mean, the first hotels in space will be these Spartan things, so like Dennis going to the International Space Station, where basically you kind of camp out. But, when they start competing on quality of experience, assuming we get there, then you're going to have larger staff. Now you might have that.
Okay. You have another caller, and let me remind everybody, we have an on-time closure of the show today, and I have two lengthy emails to read, and I have a caller. So, hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is Tom calling from Northern Virginia.
Okay.
Hi, Al.
Hi, Tom.
How's it going? Great show. I'll be very brief.
I hear you're writing a fantastic book.
thank you. So, David, the big joke, the inside joke is Al and I have been working for about a year now on a little project that will be coming out hopefully early in 2018, a book about all this research. So, but the point I wanted to make, two points I wanted to make, you know, this is ultimately, just like everything that every space enthusiast wants to do in space is ultimately a function of transportation. And Doug's question, although Al answered it pretty well, I thought, is a function of transportation. When will the first space tourist that isn't, that hasn't already happened, go to space? When will the first space settlement happen? When will the first couple settle space? Well, that'll happen when transportation to orbit is inexpensive, safe, and reliable. And you know, we've been waiting for that for a long time. But good news is, as everyone knows, it seems to be moving along smartly now with SpaceX and Blue Origin and all the others. So, and, you know, Doug's a big moon guy, and I'm a big moon guy. We all are, right? We're all excited about that. But it's likely the transportation is going to be better established to LEO before it is established anywhere else. I think that's safe to assume. So you're going to have your first settlement most likely in LEO before, or you're going to have better transportation to LEO before you have it to the moon. The other thing I wanted to mention, getting back to the economics, you know, I've been struggling with myself. That first settlement, say we have cheap transportation and say we have space tourism. Okay. These are up in the air right now. We've been waiting a long time for both. Let's say those two things happen. That first space settlement, those first 500 living units, you know, 500 units at 17 tons per unit. That's what we need theoretically to build that first smallish space settlement that Al has worked on and described. You know, I just did some quick Googling, and this year, in the Washington, D.C. region alone, almost 1,000 people bought a housing unit that was more than $1 million. That's just one city in one year. I'm sure there's just as many people in the San Francisco Bay Area, Silicon Valley area, and, you know, then you multiply it by all the major metropolitan areas throughout the world. You know, there's got to be 500 people who once transportation is established and once space tourism is proven and it's safe and people are going to space regularly, I think that it'd be pretty easy to find 500 people willing to take a risk to buy a multi-million-dollar space condo. I'll put that out there. I might be completely off base. That's just my thought. So.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
How do you deal with the property rights issue in condos, since that would be a property in space?
It's absolutely no problem at all, according to the Outer Space Treaty, because any satellite is not a heavenly body. It's a satellite. And the satellite is the responsibility of the launching nation, according to the Outer Space Treaty. So if you launch this facility primarily from the United States, then it would be subject to the laws of the United States. And there is no problem. I mean, communication satellite, people want communication satellites all the time, and nobody questions the fact that they own the satellite that they launch.
So
it's a completely non-issue for free space settlements. Now, if you're on the moon,
it's a different story.
Different.
Yeah. You've got an email from Adrian, who's in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
He's quoting, I don't know what he's quoting, quote, "What currently has geophysicists like us abuzz is the realization that the strength of Earth's magnetic field has been decreasing for the last 160 years at an alarming rate. This collapse is centered in a huge expanse of the southern hemisphere, the South Atlantic Anomaly, extending from Zimbabwe to Chile, known as the South Atlantic Anomaly. The magnetic field strength is so weak that it's a hazard for satellites that orbit above the region. The field no longer protects them from radiation, which interferes with satellite electronics," close quote. And then he gives a website for that. Then he goes on to say, "As the Earth's magnetic field drops to zero in future and before its next full cycle of reversal, how do you propose to protect the very large population proposed living in even low Earth orbit? Would another mass space refugee migration occur, returning everyone back to Earth?"
Well, I mean, there's actually a paper in the NSS Space Settlement Journal about this very topic by Heppenheimer, who's a really good science writer, and he proposes the notion that that the South Atlantic anomaly is moving and that the magnetic field is collapsing and possibly doing reversal. And he goes into there's some data from previous reversals and so forth and so on. There are other people in that business who I contact to find out, you know, if Heppenheimer is completely full of it or not, who will tell you exactly the opposite, and that the magnetic field is quite stable. And I haven't heard this 160-year decline. I have a little bit of a question about how you would know. You know, how do you measure, where do you get data from 160 years ago that tells you how strong the magnetic field was? I mean, maybe there is, I don't know. In any case, if there is magnetic field collapses and it turns into this, you know, complaint thing, then there's no particular reason to believe that ELEO will survive. The reason, by the way, that ELEO orbits, equatorial low Earth orbits, have relatively radiation is they don't pass through the South Atlantic anomaly. They pass just north of it. So now the South Atlantic anomaly does move around, and if it moved around in such a way that you had a lot of radiation in ELEO, then you would either have to accept a higher radiation level, which you might be able to do because you have more experience, or you might have to abandon ship and launch it and then, you know, boost it up high so it won't come down anytime soon. Now, I will point out that if you want to settle space anywhere else, there is also a significant probability that evacuation will be necessary, and evacuation will be harder. And the reason it will be harder is because the bloody thing is farther away. You can't get closer than an ELEO settlement. So, yeah, okay, living, let's be clear. Living in space is going to be dangerous for a long time. And it's going to involve potentially bad things to happen. But, you know something, I've noticed that there's been a few bad things happen here on Earth, you know?
Do you know of any insurance companies that write property loss for magnetic field collapse?
I've never heard of it.
Or that will be a new line of casualty insurance, maybe by the time all this happens.
Yeah. Well, there is an issue that if the Earth's magnetic field got disorganized, that would allow space radiation to impinge on the Earth. Although we do have the atmosphere to protect us too. It's not just the magnetic field. The atmosphere provides about 10 tons per square meter at sea level, which is a lot and a lot of it's water, which is particularly good at stopping cosmic rays. This is a real issue. I'm the editor in chief of that journal, and I accepted that paper and got it peer reviewed and because I think that's a totally legitimate issue. I don't think that it's sufficiently well established that we can say at this point that ELEO settlement doesn't work. That may come, but I don't see it being. You know, looking at Heppenheimer's data, which I'm sure is pretty good, about the best around, I don't see a smoking gun. I see a suggestion that there may be a problem, but nothing more than that. Again, there are, you know, a huge number of problems with living in space, and this is one of them for this particular orbit.
Claire is in Boston with an email and says, what can advocates, let me rephrase that, please, what can serious advocates do to make this happen or at least start to happen rather than just write papers, talk about it, call a talk show?
Well, there are three programs to try to influence influence Congress and the administration to do stuff. And the one I'm associated with is the Alliance for Space Development. I'm on the board of that organization. And that organization has specifically, it comes up with four or five goals each year. And those goals are intended to, if they are achieved, to support development and eventually settlement of space. Okay? And the gapless transition legislation I told you about, NASA was supposed to develop, to produce a report by December 1st, to say how they were going to transfer from government-owned space stations to privately-owned space stations in a gapless manner. That legislation was you know, in a good deal of result, as a result of the activity of the Alliance for Space Development. The first year that commercial crew got full funding was also the first year the Alliance for Space Development lobbied for commercial crew to get full funding in the Congress. Now, I'm not saying that there's necessarily a causative link. I really don't know. But I do know that every year prior to that year, the commercial crew program was underfunded. And that year, the year that we went in and started lobbying, they got full funding. And there's a couple other things that have been successful and so forth. There is also one of the objectives of the ASD is ULCATS, ultra-low-cost access to space, which, of course, is critical to everything. And then the SEDS bill, which is the to make settlement and development an explicit part of NASA's what NASA's supposed to do. NASA, right now, if you look at the legislation, the guiding legislation, does not have a mandate to develop and settle space. And this bill would change that. Now, the Alliance for Space Development has a couple of activities. One is called the March Storm, which you can Google and you can sign up for. And the idea is you go to Washington for a week in March, and you are provided with congressional offices to go talk to, usually staffers. Sometimes you'll see the member, the congressman or senator, but mostly you see staffers. But that's okay because, you know, for particularly things like space, the staffers are often the most important people. So there's the March Storm. There's also the August Blitz, which is also an ASD operation, but more focused on the National Space Society. And they do the same thing as the March Storm, except they do it in the home offices of the candidates. Because in August, Congress is generally off, and they're back in their home district raising money and trying to get votes. So one of the things you can do is join the March Storm. Go to Washington, D.C., and lobby Congress directly to do some of the things that need to be done. Another is you could join the August Blitz, which doesn't involve traveling to Washington, D.C., and accomplishes the same sort of thing. The other thing, you can get involved with some of the organizations that are pushing this stuff, like the National Space Society, of which I'm on the board, and the Space Frontier Foundation, which is the other major partner in the ASD. That's another thing you do. The other thing is you can, you know, start a company and build great rockets, which is, what, of course, what Elon did. But there's other things to do. Actually, here's a big deal is high-intensity agriculture. This is something that is building up on land. There's a market at Holland, actually. The Netherlands does a lot of work in this area, and they have huge, greenhouse farms that produce, you know, astounding amounts of food. And this is all the sort of thing you're going to have to do to get the agricultural system to work on a space settlement. And there's lots of opportunities to be an entrepreneur in the food business. I'll give you just one example. There is a company, I can't remember the name offhand, that you can go and buy from them a shipping crate. And that shipping crate has got everything inside it needs to grow leafy greens. And you can stick that shipping crate anywhere you want it, in an empty lot in a city, okay? And you plug it into electricity, and you plug it into water, and you hire a staff to handle the plants, and you can be selling leafy greens to local restaurants 365 days a year. It's all worked out. You just have to execute. And this is the sort of agriculture that you're going to have to do on the space station, on space settlements. And after transportation, probably the hardest single thing to do in a space settlement is to get the agriculture right. It is way harder than I used to think it was. I've been studying it lately. If you want to learn more about that, there's also a paper on space agriculture at the NSS Space Settlement Journal.
And that's off of their website, right?
Yeah, if you Google NSS Space Settlement Journal, it'll take you right there. There's a paper by Bryce Mayer. It's one of the best papers on space agriculture I've ever seen. And the other, if you Google Netherlands agriculture, you can find out a lot about the latest and greatest in closed and semi-closed agricultural systems. They're really hot in there. They produce an enormous amount of food.
Do you see space settlement bypassing the government and becoming a private sector operation?
Well, eventually, absolutely.
No, I mean initially. Is that a path?
I see it as a public-private cooperation. If you work out, I mean, when I did the EASY paper, I calculated the transportation costs given the best data available at the time. I came up with $1.25 million per settler to get them on board owning their condo. And here's the problem. I probably underestimated the mass of the agricultural system, so that price is going to go up, maybe by quite a bit, okay? And that's just the transportation cost. You throw in construction and so forth, cost, you're going to be looking at least $3-5 million per condo. That's pretty steep, okay? So I think, and the other thing is there's a lot of government R&D and standards production and, you know, regulatory stuff that the government needs to do to make all this stuff happen anyways. So my feeling is this is an area where the government and the private sector can work together. For instance, the government might make sure that the different sorts of tourist modules that are developed can interoperate. So if you have a space hotel with three modules from Company A, you can turn around and buy the next two modules from Company B. So you have a real market, not just a monopoly masquerading as a free market. So I see a very strong role for government in support. Now, the thing about, we tend to think of NASA, as you think, NASA decides they want to do X, right? They want to go to Mars, they want to go to the moon, whatever. Or Congress tells NASA, thou shalt do X. And then NASA goes to industry and says, well, how can you help us? You know, here's an RFP. You make a proposal, and if you're the best one, we'll pick you and we'll do yours. So we have industry catering to what NASA wants to do or what NASA has been told to do by Congress or the administration. I think the model should be quite different. I think that NASA should be supporting what the industry do. So instead of telling industry thou shalt do X, NASA says, what does he want to do? How can we help? Okay. And NASA can help, and NASA can help a lot. Go talk to Elon Musk about NASA's role in the development of the Falcon 9. It was critical to success. In many, many, many different ways. And that, I think that's the right model. Public-private. But I assume we don't need to bash either side. They've all got their advantages and their disadvantages, and we need them both.
Carla from Tucson, Arizona sent in an email, and she says, is space settlement primarily a United States thing, or do you find it to be far-reaching all over the globe?
Well, I run a space settlement contest for kids. The vast majority of the entries that I get every year are from overseas. The vast majority. The father of space settlement, Tsiolkovsky, which I'm probably mispronouncing his name terribly, was a Russian school teacher around 1900. And he came up with all these ideas, not every one of them, but most of these ideas, over 100 years ago. And he's a Russian. Okay. The Russians have, you know, they have built the most space stations, and they've operated the space stations for the longest of anybody in the world. And they have, you know, a lot of their literature is very settlement oriented. I don't really know too much about the Chinese space program, and, you know, whether they're aiming for settlement or they're aiming for, you know, flags and footprints. But I will say that the thing that we shouldn't do, and which NASA has a tendency to want to do, and many advocates for NASA want to do, is fall into the trap of the flags and footprints. What we really want is stick an American flag on Mars and tromp around and put our footprints there, and then they'll all swell up with pride and think about how great we are. The problem is we did that. We did that in the moon. We went there, we put in flags and footprints, and then the whole thing died. Because it had no commercial value. It had very, very little compared to the cost. And it was really done for prestige. It was really chess. What it really was about was chess beating. We are better than the Ruskies. Okay? And that is not sustainable, right? Because once you prove that you're better than the Ruskies, then you don't need to do it anymore, and that's exactly what happened. So we need to build something with stronger roots and stronger foundations. This does not depend entirely on government funding. There's a mix of private and government funding. And we need to be in support of the activities of that people want to do, whatever that might be, whether they want to go to space for a trip, whether they want to go to space to live. The government should support them in a reasonable manner. I mean, the government has lots of other things to do, and vast majority of government, U.S. government money is not spent on space, or in very tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of that money is spent in space settlement. But that's what I think we need to be looking out for.
Okay, I have two more emails that will probably take us to the end of the program. Adrian has a follow-up. A few weeks ago, the starving and semi-ostracized country of North Korea launched the Hwaswan, can't pronounce it, 15 missile that soared 4,475 kilometers, 2,800 miles into the sky. In the future, as this technology becomes even more widespread to even smaller groups, what is to prevent a horrendous act of destruction of a LEO colony by a similar deranged group?
Well, the same thing that prevents the destruction of New York. There are four or five countries that could obliterate New York in a half an hour. But they don't do it. Now, do they?
Not yet.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're going to be, there's, something in Leo. You know, if you're on the moon or Mars, I got news for you. People can do the same thing to you. It's a little harder, but it's harder for you to get there. You know? If you have a orbital settlement anywhere, it's got the same vulnerabilities. It's just the farther away it is, the harder it is to pull it off, but the harder it was to build that space settlement in the first place. And it's a lot easier to build something that can intercept a satellite than it is to build a space settlement. It's not easy, by the way. You have to get there at the right time, but it can certainly be done. It's true. If you had a war going on, somebody could target your settlement and destroy it. Just like Mosul was destroyed, and Tikrit was destroyed, and large parts of Afghanistan were destroyed, and most of Europe was destroyed in the Second World War. I mean, this is the human condition, and we have to live with it because we are human.
Yeah, and my way of thinking, Adrian, which many will think is Neanderthal, but what the hell, you make the consequences so horrible for the party that does do something like that, that even the most deranged would not attempt to do it. And that requires the capability to levy such consequences on a country and the political will to do that. So that's how I would make sure that didn't happen. But
deterrence is basically how the nuclear powers have determined that they're not going to blow each other.
Yeah, but it requires a level of rationality that may not always be there.
I think that a lot of the leaders who we consider irrational are not in the least bit irrational, but they are working from a different set of facts. And by the way, true facts. And just in the case of North Korea, for example, the United States, during the Korean War, bombed the ever-living daylights out of North Korea. North Korea has never bombed the United States for all the stupid-ass things they've done. They did invade the South. But their perspective is, oh, these guys bombed us all the time. We're gonna try to establish some deterrence. So they can't bomb us because we'll blow up Seattle. That's if you think at it from their point of view, that makes perfect sense. It's not irrational. It's not even a little bit irrational.
Well, it's
that's the problem. It does make sense, right?
It's only rational if their motivation is deterrence, and that's the element that you don't know.
No, I don't.
And so
it makes perfect sense.
And to go to Doug's question, which will probably be the final one of the day, what's the single biggest challenge with space agriculture? The ISS is growing lettuce. Semi-professionals do hydroponics, small scale. So he says, what's the biggest challenge with agriculture?
The hardest part is to close the loop. So you've got, you eat your food, and you urinate, and you defecate, and you've got to take that urine and feces, and you've got to run it through the system again. Okay? And that does not have a driver to develop the technology on Earth. There's also some other serious problems. Spinning up is hard. If you think about it, you start with nothing, and how do you get this system going just a little bit, and then adding a little bit? And how do you deal with system fragility? How do you build a system that won't crash when things go wrong, right? And all of a sudden you don't have any food. The thing is, if you haven't spent much time studying, people by the way, that lettuce looks terrible. I mean, it looks like some of the weak, sickliest plants I've ever seen on the space. That doesn't mean you can't grow good stuff on the station, but that lettuce is not a particularly good example. You have to eat an awful lot of lettuce to keep going. For instance, this high-intensity agriculture mostly doesn't work very well for grains. And potatoes and things like that. When you start getting into the weeds, when you start actually trying to grow food, it gets really difficult really quickly. And it's not everything works from a physics and biological point. There's nothing that says you just can't do this. It's just hard. It's hard to get right, and it's hard not to screw it up. It's hard not to screw up my garden in back of my house, If I had to depend on that garden for food, I would starve to death.
Bring me down there, and I'll screw it up in no time. I can't even grow an indoor plant without screwing it up. So,
right. Well, I had a roommate that once killed a cactus by forgetting to water it.
That's pretty hard to do.
You got to work. It took 2 years.
We're at the end of the program. What Christmas cheer and end of 2017 message do you want to leave us with today?
We are in a gold. The hardest part of space settlement is the transportation, and we are in a golden era of launcher development. There has never been a time when so many and such capable launchers were under development, and there has never been a time when the price of launch has come down as much as it has in the last 2 or 3 years, ever. We are in a great, 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 wonderful time in terms of the most serious problem and the second most serious problem in agriculture. We are also in a golden era of development. This is something that's developing commercially very rapidly. People are selling stuff in bulk all over the world. A lot of our work is getting done for us.
Al, thank you for being with us, and I look forward to the groundbreaking for your. Is that what we're gonna? Is that what we're gonna call an ELEO station groundbreaking?
Yeah, it makes no sense because there's no ground.
I know you gotta come up with something else. A space breaking. I don't know what that might be, but I'm looking forward to that. So hopefully it'll happen sooner than later.
Yeah.
Listeners, given that we did not take a break, I do want to again acknowledge the sponsors from the second segment, Orbital ATK, which, as everyone knows, is a global leader and a partner you can count on, and we thank them for their sponsorship. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, a great organization, great events, great networking. Check them out at AIAA.org. And Celestis, which is still the only proven real memorial service for space that you can have. And they also now put your DNA in space, and they have missions going up either orbital, suborbital, or to the moon. Can you believe that? From Cape Canaveral, from California, and from New Zealand. Do you see the LEO space station having some sort of cemetery on board?
Settlement, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really, it might make sense. It all depends on the people living there, what they want to do, right?
Or maybe they just ejected out into space. That would be a really cool space burial too. But
yeah, then you become part of the debris problem.
Well, I assume it would burn up on the way down.
Yeah,
at times.
Well, I don't know if it would stay up for a while. I had something.
Well, So do it right, everybody, and if this interests you, get a hold of Celestis at Celestis.com. Al, thank you very much for being with us. A very happy holidays, Merry Christmas, New Year's to you and your family, and I look forward to seeing you again someplace at an event in 2018.
Okay, I'll see you then.
Thank you. Everybody, thanks for being with us. Dr. Richard Obese is back with us tomorrow, 2 p.m., a theoretical physicist, more warp drive, interstellar travel, really cool stuff like that. And then you'll see all of our programs up. We're scheduled for Tuesday, Hotel Mars on Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday is our last open line show of the year. Thank everybody for calling and talking to Al, for your emails. Thanks to Al. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Keep it safe during the holiday period. Keep looking up. Goodbye from the Space Show.